We are at the witching hour, so 7:30. So we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome all. Welcome to any guests that we have with us tonight. As always, we invite guests to join us at Ottawa PC User Group meetings. And if you want to become a member, you can go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button. It's only $20, but feel free to continue joining as a guest if you so desire. Later on tonight, and this time I can say, not like last week, unfortunately we had a technical glitch, later on this evening, the contents of the chat window, the audio track, and the PDF of the slides being shown tonight will go up on our website in the normal location. The problem we had, the glitch, has been fixed, and so we're able to edit the pages again. Okay, and with that, I guess I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks very much,
Chris. Hang on just a second. I forgot I got to mute all. So give chance to Alan to unmute himself. And away we go.
Okay, and Chris, you have slide control tonight, so...
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a few different items tonight. We're going to start off with a question that was posted on the user forum about Family Tree Maker. And the problem was that the member was trying to open a file, but was getting this message that it hadn't been, that the app hadn't been closed properly the last time. It suggested compacting the file. So the member did that and backed up the data as instructed and compressed the data. But then when they tried to open the file again, now it says that the file's in use. Close the file that's open in another program. All kinds of issues here. Now the application did it open and other files could be loaded, but not this particular one. And the member didn't know how to solve that issue. So the question got posted to the user forum, and Harvey responded almost immediately with a suggestion to contact the developer. The developer is called the Software Makiev Company, and they apparently have a live chat option. And France kicked in and said that yes, she'd tried this in the past and they'd been very good. So I don't know if the particular issue was resolved, but that was certainly the suggestion from a couple of members. So this kind of reminds everybody that if you are a member, that we do have this OPCUG member forum, which is basically a 24/7 question and answer page. So members can post questions, information that's of interest to people, and basically get responses and comments. And you have to be a member to be able to subscribe to this channel, this forum. But if you are, it's really easy. You just send an email to this email address right here, and you can basically subscribe to the OPCUG member forum and post your own questions. And the reason I introduce this is because tonight Chris has got some more information on our one-on-one remote assistance program. But before he gets into that, just let me remind people who have members who have expertise in specific software, general knowledge of operating systems or computers in general. And if you're willing to share your expertise with other members who've got a very specific problem, then what we'd like you to do is volunteer for this remote assistance program. And we've talked about this in the past, and there's a newsletter article, and all you have to do is send us an email to our regular suggestion box address, and we'll be happy to add you to the volunteer list. So,
Just before we leave that, let me assure everybody that you don't have to even consider yourself to be an expert or broad-based or anything like that. It's just if you think that you might have a chance of helping out people with something. And so you can lurk as long as you want, and if you see a problem come up that you think, oh, I could actually help that person, you can jump in at that point.
Yeah, very true, Chris. Thank you very much. And that's why I have expert in quotation marks.
Yeah.
So you don't actually have to be an expert, just have to have a bit of knowledge to pass along to people. Okay, so Chris has got more information on the actual remote assistance program.
Yeah, so, you know, my question is, you know, have you ever had a problem that couldn't be solved, particularly at Q&A? Because this is the sort of thing that we do at Q&A. We invite people to, you know, say, oh, I've got a problem with something, and see if there's somebody else who can help out with it. So that is actually, I think, still the best venue to try first. You'll have broad base. You know, we have currently 27 people on the call tonight, and so you're reaching out to a lot of people that have been around doing this sort of stuff for a long time, and so you start there. But there are some things that don't really work all that well at Q&A. Maybe it's too hard to explain it. Maybe it's just, you know, if somebody could actually see my screen, you know, they could see what it is that I'm talking about and the weird behavior that I really can't describe it. And, or I really need to show somebody when I do this, see what happens. And those are the sort of things that we sort of thought was one-on-one remote assistance. It's what spurred us on to looking at that. So one-on-one remote assistance is ready to help. We've got all of the procedures and everything worked out. So what does it really look like? Well, glad you asked. So as an overview, just looking at the overall, you know, how the program would actually work, first off, the details are at the URL there, and it's pasted into the chat. But as a broad overview of the whole thing, you started off by sending in a request for assistance to that particular email address. There are a couple of people that will triage any requests that come on and make sure that there's enough information that has been provided that it can go to our volunteers. Now, if it hasn't, the couple of people that are doing triaging will get back to you and say, get clarifications and things like that to make sure that we have enough information that somebody can say, yeah, I can help with that. So then the request gets sent to the group of volunteers. So it's a discussion group, and everybody who belongs to it will see the request. So if there's a volunteer who thinks they can actually help with that particular problem, then they can say, yeah, I'll take that one on. And then they will touch base with you and arrange a time and so forth that is good for the two of you. And then what they'll be able to do is connect remotely to your computer over the internet, and they will be able to see your screen. Optionally, you can give them permission to actually operate your mouse and keyboard so that they can actually do things on your computer. Hopefully the problem gets resolved. And as a final step, we do ask that people provide feedback on the process. How was it? Is there anything that could be improved? Was it really a satisfactory solution or an acceptable workaround, that sort of thing? So a detailed example here, we had our first example. We ran through the process. So Linda sent in a request saying that she uses Google Drive to make some large files available to other people. And all of a sudden, it was no longer working. So she explained what she normally does and then how it just wasn't an option for her to be able to continue through that process to do it. So that got triaged, and a reply went back to Linda asking for a clarification as well as a confirmation. The first one is a confirmation that we are going to ask all people that send in a request before it gets sent to volunteers to say, can anybody help with this? They'll be asked to confirm that they read and acknowledged the rules of the road as is laid out on that web page that I referenced earlier on. And in this case, I actually asked for a couple of clarifications. First off, I wanted to know if Linda was running Windows 10 or 11, because that will make a difference in how we can connect remotely to her computer. If it's Windows 10 or 11, we can use Quick Assist. If not, we'll end up having to use Zoom, which works as well, but I think the Quick Assist is a little bit better. Then I also asked if that was the email address that was going to be best to be used for the volunteer to get in touch and things like that. Also asking for a phone number, because certainly with Quick Assist, you want to be using a phone at the same time to be able to talk to the person. And then talking about scheduling, just the idea that if there are any blackout times that it's really not good to get in touch with you, it'd be a good idea if we let the volunteers know that at the same time as they get the request. There's no point in somebody stepping forward and saying, oh, I can help with that, if they can only help during the weekends and the person who needs help is away every weekend, that sort of idea. And then just the final, just saying, get back with the acknowledgement and the answer to the questions above, and then we can proceed. So Linda responded with that, so she acknowledged it, and she clarified the items that I need to ask for clarification on. And so then the request went to the volunteers with that additional information, saying that, yes, she's using Windows 10, she can be contacted at a certain phone number, and she's available evenings or weekends to work on the program, on the problem. And then we asked the volunteers to, anybody who can pick it up, reply back to the group so we don't have five people trying to contact Linda. We want to triage that end of it and make sure that we pick one person to be able to work with Linda on the problem. So a volunteer picked it up. So this nefarious character, Chris Taylor, said use Google Drive a lot and familiar with several things that can cause that sort of problem, and let Linda know that I'll contact her. So I, as the volunteer, contacted Linda. I verified that she had Microsoft Quick Assist installed. If she hadn't had it installed, it would be no big deal for me to walk her through installing it over the phone call. And then arranged a date and time for a remote access session where we could work on the problem. So during that remote access session, I verified, in this case, that Google Drive app was actually installed on the computer. I saw that it wasn't actually running. I started it, verified that it functioned properly by synchronizing a file and getting a shareable link, which is what Linda was trying to get for people that she was sending large files to. And then I showed Linda how to deal with that problem if it returned, how to recognize that the problem was there, that it was the same problem. I stopped Google Drive. I had Linda go through the process of recognizing that the problem was that Google Drive was not functioning or wasn't running at the time, manually starting it up and synchronizing a file. So I verified with Linda that she understands what went wrong and how to deal with it in the future. She agreed that she did understand it. I asked her to send an email to the one-on-one request email address indicating that it was resolved to her satisfaction and providing feedback on the process. And then I documented all of that and closed it off. So the close-off request came through. I sent this to Linda just saying, this came from the one-on-one request saying that got information from Chris Taylor that it was fixed. Do you understand that we are now closing this call? You can open it up again later on if necessary, but other than that, we'll consider it closed. And then asking, was it resolved to satisfaction, and was there any way it could be done better? And Linda responded with, she was very pleased with the assistance that was provided, didn't just resolve the issue, but I feel capable of fixing it myself if it happens again. And that's what we really want. We want this to be a learning process that in the future you'll be more self-sufficient because you'll really understand the problem and therefore understand how to fix the problem. And then the request was documented and closed off. So that was basically it. And anything that we have coming through is basically going to go through that same process. And it's not going to be really rigid because every request may have nuances on it that may necessitate some variance of it. But that's the basic process that it'll go through. So the doors are open right now. So anybody who has an issue, by all means, you can follow through on that, and we'll see what we can do to help you out. So if we have any questions.
Chris.
Okay, yep.
Bill wants to know, how is it going to work on a Linux machine?
We would end up using Zoom on that as opposed to Quick Assist.
And Harvey wants to know, if a volunteer wants to help a requester, and do they notify OPCUG? First, how does that work, basically?
Sorry, what was that?
When a volunteer wishes to help the requester,
yeah.
Do they have to notify OPCG first?
Yeah,
I mean, this is all done through the Google group, right?
Yeah, we have a Google group that is for the volunteers. And so if a volunteer sees some issue that comes through on there that they say, oh, I know how to help that person, they can reply back to that group of people and say, oh, I understand that one. I can take this call. And then everybody else can just sort of back off and say, oh, okay, somebody is going to help them out. At that point, the triage group would get in touch with the original requester saying, we found a volunteer. They will get in touch with you. And in a sort of parallel fashion, the person who does volunteer can get in touch with the requester and take it from there.
And Stu wants to know what happens if there's a bilingual. Is the bilingual assistance available?
We have, I believe, one volunteer at least that is bilingual.
Two, I think.
Yeah. I don't know beyond that. So as a general rule, I would say you're best if you can do it in English, but if you absolutely need it to be in French, specify that in your original request, and we'll see what we can do to satisfy that.
Yeah, Jocelyn's saying he can support French, and Bob Harris says that's great. He's got to learn French. Okay, so the phones are open, or the emails are open. We're just waiting for that next case to come through the doors. Okay, thanks very much, Chris, and we'll see what happens from going forward.
Oh, and just a final word on that. This is the second service that is only available to members. So I've been promoting at the Ottawa Public Library presentations, and I've had an awful lot of ears perk up when they hear about one-on-one, but you do have to be a member in order to take advantage of this service. So if you're promoting it to other people, let them know that they'll have to become a member.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so next up, I'm going to carry on with my mini-series on moving to Linux. And I'll just remind everybody that Windows 10 reaches end of life in just under a year now. And my issue is I've got a number of computers that won't upgrade to Windows 11. I'm not interested in buying a whole bunch more hardware, so I'm thinking of switching up. Okay. So, just as a follow-up to the stuff I talked about last week, using setting up a live USB. If you do want to continue using Windows 10 after October the 14th next year, Microsoft have indicated that there will be an option of paying for extended security updates, this ESU program. However, at the time of writing, like now, they haven't announced the pricing and how this is all going to work. Interesting, one of the things on their website, it says that this extended security support will be free if you're a Windows 365 customer. So if you're already buying 365 services, then ESUs will be free for you. Isn't that interesting? However, there's another little catch here that if you do buy into this service for however much it's going to cost, it's only going to be available for 3 years after 2025. So there is a time limit, even though you're paying for this extended support. This is a slide from Explaining Computers, Christopher Barnett, and he notes that there's a price for educational outlets, and it's really cheap. Except it doubles every year. So for education, they pay $1 for a machine for 1 year, and then the second year support goes up to $2, and the third year support goes up to $4. However, if you're a commercial enterprise, then the first year is going to cost you $61, second year it doubles to $122, and the third year it doubles again to $244. So they're paying, companies are going to be paying $427 over 3 years per seat. So it's not an inexpensive proposition necessarily for business. So the question is, where is it going to fall for the home user? And right now we don't know. But just remember, even if it's reasonable, somewhere in between those two prices maybe, it's only good for 3 years, and then you still have to think about what to do going forward. Another question that was asked last week was, how long is mint going to last? And I suggested we're going to be using the current release, which is Mint 22, which is a long-term support version. So I took a look at the kind of history of Linux Mint, and it turns out it was released in 2006. So that was version 1.1, which was codenamed Ada. And that's getting on almost 20 years ago. So they've been pumping out Mint editions for almost 20 years. So I think that tells you it's not going away very quickly. The long-term support is indeed for 5 years, as I thought it was. And this current edition, 22, codenamed Wilma, is long-term support, so it's going to be good for 5 years from now and up until 2029. And if you look at the relatively recent long-term support versions, starting at, this table starts at version 17, it was released in May 2014, and 5 years support to 2019. You notice that in 2016, there's a second long-term support version, version 18. And then there's 2 years later, version 19. So although you get 5 years support on the LTS version, there's a new LTS version basically every 2 years. So there's lots and lots of opportunity for this thing to continue for fairly long time periods. Okay, so as I said previously, my plan is to basically dual boot Linux. And last time we were looking at how to create a bootable USB and how to boot into that USB into the Linux desktop, running strictly from the USB, not actually install it on the computer, but just running it from the USB as a kind of a test version. And what I want to do tonight is just go through briefly the applications that come bundled with Mint, because you're not just getting an operating system, you're getting a whole software universe, as it were, in the package. So when you use the USB and when you install it on your computer, you have all of this software already available to you. The interface is very much like Windows, in my opinion, lots of people's opinion. There's a start menu, a main menu button on the bottom left-hand corner of the screen. And when you click on that button, it pops up this menu, and the software is broken out into various categories. And the main menu categories are accessories, graphics applications, programs that help you on the internet, there's an office suite, audio and video, and then some administration, preferences, and then a couple of options here for places, which is kind of disk drives, and then recent files that you have opened relatively shortly previously. And there's also a sidebar menu, which is customizable. And one of the good things about Linux is it's highly customizable. So you can take things off this sidebar, you can add things onto this sidebar. So it kind of becomes a bit of a kind of a favorites type thing. You notice at the top there's Firefox, the web browser, that's built in. Software manager is really interesting. We'll talk about that later. There's a settings option. There's a terminal, which is like the Windows command window, which everybody thinks you need to use that to run Linux, but these days you don't. Everything can be run pretty much by a graphical user interface, a GUI. There's a file manager, which is very much like File Explorer. There's a lock screen if you want to walk away from your computer and lock it down. And then there's a way to log out and a power button to actually shut the computer down. So accessories, as you might might imagine there's a whole bunch of those. One of them is an archive manager, so you can deal with zip files. That's built in. You can create zip files or unpack archive files. There's a PDF viewer. The file manager is called Nemo. That's the one that's used by Mint by default. Lots of different file managers available. You don't have to stick with Nemo if you don't like it. There's an image viewer, so you can look at pictures. There's a password manager. There's a text editor, which is a bit like Notepad or Notepad++, really, because it's tabbed. It's a tabbed editor. And then there's a built-in image writer, so you can create USBs. So you don't need software like Rufus or Polina Etcher. This image writer is built in. And if you want to move files around between different external USB drives, then there's a program called Warpinator, which will let you copy files over your local Wi-Fi network. So those are just some of the kind of basic accessory programs which are built into the Linux distro, and those are all available to you. There's 17 of them in total. They're all available to you once you start using the USB. Here's a screenshot of the file manager. This is Nemo. You notice it's looking at the home directory, and there's a bunch of folders in there. And then on the left-hand side, there's a menu, just like Windows File Explorer. You can get to these different files. And down the bottom here, there's a bunch of icons that you can links that you can access various USB drives and the like. So very similar to File Explorer, although it has a few little wrinkles that work much better than File Explorer, in my opinion. In terms of graphics, not really an awful lot here. There's a document scanner, so if you have a multifunction printer with a scanning capability or a dedicated scanner, you can probably hook it up to this software and drive your scanner directly from Linux Mint. There's a drawing program which gives you simple drawing capabilities, and Pix is a digital image manager which lets you look after all your digital photos. On the internet side of things, we've already seen that the Firefox is the web browser. There's an instant messaging application called Matrix. If you want to use email, then Thunderbird is the Mozilla product, which is really good. It's actually multi-platform, so I've been using that on both Linux and Windows, and it's a really good email client. If you're into BitTorrent downloads, then there's a program for that called Transmission. And Web Apps is a program that will let you load a website basically directly from your desktop. So if you need that capability, again, that is also built in. So the two big ones there really are Firefox as a web browser and Thunderbird as the email client. I mentioned the Office Suite, and I think everybody probably knows that the default Office Suite in Mint is LibreOffice. So you have Writer, which is like Word. You have Calc, which is like Excel. You have Impress, which is like PowerPoint. And then there's another module called LibreOffice Draw, which is a drawing package, which doesn't have an equivalent in Microsoft Office. There's also a calendar built in, and this application called Thingy, which they put in the category of library, and basically lets you access favorite documents. So Writer, I said it looks a lot like Word, and here is Writer with one of my Linux, trading up to Linux articles. And you notice there that you've got a whole ribbon of tools to open files and save files and change fonts and change sizes and make it bold and make it italic. Very similar to Microsoft Word. And in fact, LibreOffice Writer is essentially compatible with Microsoft Word. You can open .doc files, .docx files, and you can save text to Microsoft format files. And the same with Calc. it will handle Excel files. Sound and video applications, again, these applications are built into the Linux Mint distro. So if you want to watch videos, then you have a program called Celluloid. If you want to listen to music files, you have a program called Rhythmbox, which is an audio player. And there's another application which sounds really interesting, Hypnotics, is a TV player. And it's a player for free television stations from across the world. It sounds great. My limited amount of testing on this thing, there are very few channels that actually do very much, on the, at least in the English-speaking world. I don't know about Swedish or Turkish or all the other things you can access on this thing. But it's an interesting program, and one of these days I'll play around with it and really see if it does have any useful capabilities. You also have the option to install multimedia codecs. You know that some encoding schemes are actually proprietary, and a lot of Linux systems won't install them directly for you. In Mint, they're available. And this is a bit like Thunderbird as an email client. There's not much point in setting up Thunderbird on your USB drive, because when you shut the USB drive, you will lose your Thunderbird configuration. So it's best to hold off doing that until you actually install the software. And we'll see that later on when we create the dual boot system that we're going to use. So although you can install the multimedia codecs, again, it's best to do that when you install the software, and then it's a one-time operation. In terms of administration, there's a bunch of oddball things like analyzing disk usage. The GNOME partition editor, gparted, is very useful. You want to create partitions on different drives, external USB drives, that kind of thing. There's a printer manager there. But the more interesting things are things like software manager, which is in Linux, all the software, well, I shouldn't say all the software, the vast majority of software that you will probably want to install is stored in online repositories. And software manager basically gives you access to all of the available software in these repositories. And it's a GUI type application, so it's very handy for installing things. Synaptic is it's kind of a GUI, but it's more of a text-based GUI, and you kind of have to know what you're looking for in that case. But it's another way to install software. And some of the other things, system monitor, a bit like task manager, is it in Windows? See what the CPU is doing, see how much memory it's taking, that kind of thing. There's a system restore utility called TimeShift, which is a backup utility, but it only backs up system files. It doesn't back up user data, so I don't actually use that. There's an update manager. I say task manager, it's not really task manager. Update manager is more like Windows Update. It's a very powerful version of Windows Update, essentially. And then if you want to play around with users and groups, then that's under this admin category too. And there's lots of applications on this. There's 18 applications on this category, so lots of things to look at. So I mentioned Software Manager, and here's just a quick look at the main screen. You can see that it gives you a bunch of featured programs. If you want to install VirtualBox or Google Earth, you just have to click on one of these panels here. You want to go looking for things, internet programs or things to do with programming or graphics, then you check these different categories down the bottom. If you know what you're looking for, you can actually just type it in the search bar here, and it will basically go out and find applications that resemble what you're looking for. And typically it'll find the exact one you're looking for. So if you want to install VLC, for example, then you can just type VLC here, click the install button, and you're off to the races. Very, very convenient. The preferences menu is a bit like settings, I guess, to some extent. It's got a bunch of accessibility tools. You can manage Bluetooth connections. This is where you would set date and time, change your display configurations, keyboard languages, that kind of thing. The sound capabilities, input, output, microphone, speakers. And also you can manage startup applications. So you can have things start that you do want, or you can stop things starting that you don't want. And again, there are 42 things to look at in this category. So lots of things to explore. And that's one of the things about Linux. There's a lot of flexibility in the system, but you have to figure out how to get there. Fortunately, there's a lot of online assistance, help files, user forums, video tutorials. You can just ask Google, how do I do this? Or Flexibility AI, how do I do that? And you'll get chapter and verse on how to do it. I mentioned the places category and the recent files. Places basically shows you the available disks and various locations. And here I've hit the places key down here, and it's popped up this list of, and you notice that these are the kind of folders in the home directory where you would store your pictures or your documents. If you're using Writer, for example, then you can access those subfolders from this menu. And the recent files one is, as I said, the list of recent files that you've accessed, and you're allowed to clear that list if you want to have a fresh start. Again, one of the things with these folders is, although you could store things in these folders, they're transient if you're only using a live USB. So if you're booted from this USB drive, and that's what you're using as your Linux Mint system, then when you shut down the USB, when you close Mint, and all these files that are stored in these folders will be lost. So again, this is one of these things that's best to wait until you've installed Linux on an actual hard drive in this dual boot mode, which we'll look at next time. Now, one of the reasons for running a live USB in the first place is, A, you can play around with all these things and see if it has some applications that would be useful to you. You can test out how do you get around the menu system and how do you do various things. But also it checks that your hardware is going to be compatible with Mint 22. Because if it won't run on the live USB, then it's probably not going to run if you try and install it on the computer. So it's best to check out what happens in the live USB before you go to the trouble of installing Linux on your computer. And indeed, one of our members did exactly that. He installed, created the USB for Mint 22. He booted his Dell Venue Pro, only to find that he couldn't get Wi-Fi access. He had a wired connection, which would be useful, but the Venue Pro wouldn't load Wi-Fi on Mint. So he looked in Google, found some information, and basically it says that this Venue Pro doesn't recognize the Wi-Fi system. So, you know, what can you do? Well, personally, I always have Wi-Fi work straight out of the box. I plug in the USB, I run the Linux Mint, and it pops up the Wi-Fi connection, and I make the connection. I've really not had any, I shouldn't say I've not had any problems. I did have one problem once when an update to Ubuntu wasn't compatible with my audio card. No, it was my Wi-Fi card. It wasn't compatible with my Wi-Fi card. So that's when I switched from Ubuntu to Mint, because Mint, it was compatible. So that's one of the things you can do. And indeed, this Venue Pro seems to be a particular problem, that a whole bunch of people have issues with both Wi-Fi and Bluetooth under Linux. And interestingly, there's a post from Dell which says that Linux, Wi-Fi, and Dell can have issues. And that's interesting because just about all the computers I've used have been Dell models, and I've only had that one problem with one Linux distro once. So my thought was that, well, maybe the wireless card in this venue isn't actually being supported by Mint 22. That could be two different reasons. One, that 22 is fairly new and they haven't got round to writing a driver for the venue, or I don't know. But basically, the two options I can think of is Google and try and find a distro that will work with the venue. That didn't sound very optimistic because Harvey had looked on Google and all he found was were problems. And the second thing you can do is you can plug in a USB dongle and see if that gives you connectivity. And it's a bit of a kludge in terms of a solution, but at least it narrows it down that, yes, it's the Wi-Fi card that's the problem, and the Linux distro has no support for that particular card. So at least you know what the problem is. Okay, so that's really the two things. Create the USB, try out Linux, see how it works, see if it's got some software that will be useful to you, and in particular, make sure that your hardware is going to be supported by this distro before you go on to install it. And which is what we're going to do next, because we've gone through phase one now. We've created the live USB, we've done the test of the hardware, we've looked at the applications, they all look great. So next time, we're going to see how we can install Linux onto a hard drive and basically retain the Windows operating system. So we'll have both operating systems on the same hard drive in different partitions, actually. But we'll have both systems available to us, and there'll be a grub menu which will let us boot either Linux or Windows when we fire up the machine. So there's something to look forward to next time we look at training up to Linux.
And Tristan has pasted into the chat, if anybody's interested, Linux Mint releases and their support. So if you're interested in finding out all of the deets and ugly little details there, the link is there for you to check that out.
Yeah, and there's lots of other distros if Mint doesn't work for you. It's just that I've been using Mint for the last few years, and that's my go-to distro right now. Okay, moving along then. Chris has got something on Windows recovery.
Yeah, so this is just something I came across on a YouTube video from Paul Thurrott, who talks about Windows a lot. So he has this channel, Hands on Windows. And it was kind of interesting because he went through all of the ways that he knows of to recover Windows 11 if you're having an issue. And so some of them are really old and some of them are quite new. Quick Assist is the one that we're primarily, I think we're going to be using on the one-on-one remote assistance program. It is built into Windows, and if you don't have it on your Windows 10 or 11 computer, you can install it from the Microsoft Store. There is the troubleshooting platform that has been built into Windows for a long time, and what they've done is brought that all into one location now under Settings, Systems, Troubleshoot, and then other troubleshooters will list off all of the troubleshooters that are available. And I've not had a great deal of success solving problems with that, but certainly it's one of the things you can go to if you're having issues with a particular subsystem like printing or network or whatever. You can create a Windows recovery drive, which will be a bootable flash drive, which will include some recovery tools on it. If you're getting to the point where you really want to reinstall Windows, reset this PC is one way of doing it, where it will actually reinstall Windows from a fresh copy downloaded from Microsoft, and it'll reinstall any of the Microsoft Store apps that you have installed, not the Win32 other apps that didn't come from the store. They would not be reinstalled, but it can keep all your data. A brand new one is the ability to fix problems using Windows Update. And so there'd be an option under Settings, Systems, Recovery, Fix Problems Using Windows Update. Not everybody is seeing that yet. It seems to be rolling out across the world gradually. And it can reinstall Windows and retain all your apps and your data. And then a really old school way of recovering things is to use the system restore feature. So the URL is there in the chat, so you can watch the video, see all the different ways that you can do recovery. And I see from Tom, recovery, prepare by printing out your disk lock keys. Yeah, it's always a good idea to have your disk lock keys so that you have access to your drive. So that's all I had on that one. And then I guess the next one up is me as well. And this one here, I'm just going to paste in the URL for this one. So this is another one that came across just browsing on the YouTube and was linked to something else. Plus codes for location information in primarily, I think at this point in time, it's to do with Google Maps. But if you ever had a hard-to-find location or something that was really difficult to describe, you know, something like, please deliver the pizza to this particular address, but it's not really that address. It's the door is actually around the left side of the building, down five stairs, you know, something like that. Or repair shop is in the strip mall. It's the fourth door from the right end of the south corridor near the pet shop. Or, even worse, you could have something like, I'll meet you at the north end of the lake 3 kilometers north of Smith Falls on Highway 15 near the fallen birch tree. Any of those locations are rather hard for you to give to somebody else and have confidence that the other person is actually going to be able to locate you. So what if you had a short unique identifier for anywhere in the world, accurate to about 3 meters or less? There have been prior systems, such as What Three Words, but it never seemed to catch on. It was an interesting concept, but I last heard anybody use it years ago. So along comes Google Plus Code. So it was developed in 2014, so it's been around a while. It works with Google Maps, and there are some other mapping systems that can use it as well. But given the way Google takes over the world, maybe this one will actually catch on, whereas you know, the one that was based on three words didn't really catch on. So it uses a 10-character code, typically. It can be shorter or longer. So it'll look something like this. So it uses only 20 alphanumeric characters, and the reason why is they eliminated any ones that are look-alike, or you know, like a 1 and an I or an L or something like that, so you could easily confuse it if you were looking at it and trying to type it in manually. It excludes vowels. It's not case-sensitive. So every effort is made to make sure that you can accurately type in this information. The size of the area is defined by a plus code. So a 10-character plus code will define things down to a 14 by 14 meter square. An 11-character plus code would bring it down to 3 by 3. And an 11-character, it's always in that after the plus, you normally have two characters, and by adding a third character to that, brings it down to that added accuracy. Plus codes can also be simplified, you know, by adding a location name to it and eliminating some of the early numbers. So in this case here, we eliminate the 87Q6 and we add on to the end a place name for it. And this is Somerset, Ottawa, Ontario. And that was actually Somerset Ward as opposed to Somerset Street. I was confused when I first saw it, but it turns out that it was a ward. So how do you get a plus code for a location? So you can open up Google Maps on your web or web browser or on your phone, find the location you want by either searching for it or just browsing for it, drop down a pin by touching and holding the screen or by using your current location. If you're using a GPS, there will be a blue dot typically on the screen. You could use that for your location. Tap, click on the location, it'll bring up an information panel, and then the plus code will be displayed in the information panel next to the plus code logo, which you see in the top right corner of the screen. And it'll look something like this. So this is typically what they will give you is the abbreviated form of it. So the four characters, plus sign, three characters, and then a friendly description of it. It could be abbreviated even further. So in this case here, I might be able to abbreviate that down to just the four characters, plus sign, three characters, and then just say Ottawa on, maybe. We'll see that a little bit in where you can and can't do that or what the ramifications are. And then you click the icon to copy the plus code to the clipboard, and then you can email that off to somebody or text it to them or whatever you need to do. So how many characters are actually required? So if you have a full 10 character, that's one location in the world, period. It'll define it. So that plus code right there is for the Peace Tower on Parliament Hill. If I remove the leading two characters, so I bring it down to eight characters, that can actually define quite a few locations in the world. And it depends on where you start your search as to where it'll end up turning up. So if I go into Google Maps and I have Hamilton centered on the screen and I search for that, it will actually give me the Peace Tower. If I happen to start the search when my Google Maps is on Miami, it'll actually give me a location east of the Bahamas. And if I start the search with Adelaide, Australia, on the screen, it'll actually give me a result halfway to Sydney, Australia. So by eliminating those first two characters, you're actually giving it a chance to have a lot of locations, and it's context sensitive as to where you start your search. So we can also, if we go back and we look at that one location, what if we remove four characters? Six characters in this case. So we leave it as two characters plus and two characters. So we remove the leading 87, Q6, C8, and obviously that's going to define an awful lot of different locations in the world, in this case millions of locations. If I start the search with Google Maps in Ottawa, so I did it from the Civic Campus, then it will actually define me as being Peace Tower. If I start from Billings Bridge, then the result will actually be Heron Road and Colonel By Drive. So this gives you an idea about context. So getting a plus code. So tap and hold to create the PIN, and the plus code will appear in the info panel. And then I can click that icon to copy the plus code to the clipboard. There's another way you can do this, and I find this actually just a little bit easier. Rather than just going to Google Maps, if you go to plus.codes/map, it'll allow you to do similar sort of things, but a little bit nicer interface. So you can search for your address or navigate to the location as you would in Google Maps. And then it will give you, you can click on the map, and it'll actually give you the location in a little box. And you'll also see a satellite image of that location, which can be handy. And then you'll actually get three forms of the location. You get a simple plus code, the full plus code, as well as, if you want it, the latitude and longitude of that location. So you're sending that plus code to somebody else. You have an email option. So you could actually, you can copy it to the clipboard, just email it to them. But you can also click on email. It'll open up your email, and it will give you the information pasted in automatically. So it gives both the shortened plus code as well as the full plus code. So navigating to a plus code, open up the Google Maps on your phone or web browser, enter the plus code in the search box, and the Google Maps will pop to that location. Very straightforward. So here's a demonstration of it. I'm centered on London, England, and I enter in the plus code in the search box, and Google Maps jumps over to Parliament Hill. And that's it for plus codes.
I think just want to know why you exclude vowels in the code.
I think it was primarily for things like so you don't have O or zero was definitely one of the things in there. But other than that, I don't know. They just decided they needed they were satisfied with 20 codes, and it's not like you make them up, so they are there, and worldwide it could be satisfied with 20 alphanumeric codes, so that's what they went with. They open sourced the whole technology of it so that anybody can actually write applications that will use plus codes, and seems to work whether it really catches on. As I say, it's been around for 10 years now, but it's there if you want to try and use it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I put a note in the chat earlier asking for any other questions. I haven't seen anything pop up, so if anybody has any other questions or comments on computer technology of the day, now's the time to type something into the chat window or open your microphone and talk to us. Okay. Right. Well, let me go through the wrap-up slides, what everybody's thinking. As Chris mentioned early on, we fixed the problem on the website, so the files will be posted to the Q&A page as normal tonight, hopefully, if Mr. Zoom sorts out his audio processing in reasonable time. So look for the files on the regular Q&A page. Just remind you again, our one-on-one remote assistant lines are open. So if you have a question that you think will be suitable for this program, then take a look at this website. And there's a link on the homepage which will tell you all about it and give you the information as to how to contact us. Which, if I remember rightly, was one-on-one request at opcu.ca.
That's right.
Okay, coming up, we have some Ottawa Library presentations. If anybody missed Chris's member presentation or meeting presentation on typography, he has this at Rosemount, actually tomorrow night, Fun with Fonts, The Art and Science of Typography. And Linda's going to be busy on the 28th. She has a session at North Gloucester on organizing photos at 2 p.m. And then if you want to know about traveling in Ireland and Scotland, then she's got a slideshow at Carlingwood at 6 p.m. on the same day. And interestingly enough, the National Capital Freenet newsletter came out today, and if you missed this session on password management by somebody we know and love, Chris is going to be repeating that for National Capital Freenet on the 13th. You have to register, but the URL here takes you to Brightworks, whatever it's called. Chris, help me out here.
Sorry.
What's the place called? Oh, Eventbrite.
Eventbrite,
and you basically just register and you can get a ticket. And this is an interesting one. It's going to be hybrid, so it's going to be in person at a location, but also it's going to be available over Zoom. So either drive and talk to Chris directly or watch the thing on a Zoom call.
When you get to the Eventbrite registration page, it'll ask you whether you want to attend in person or over Zoom.
Okay, so Harvey was asking...
Can anybody hear me?
Yes.
All right. Chris, you mentioned System Restore earlier. It's important to know that System Restore will not work if you don't create a System Restore point beforehand. So the way to do is you type Restore in the search box and at the bottom on the bar of Windows. And you go to Configure System Restore, and then you go to Create, and then you name it whatever you want.
Yeah, I believe the Paul Tarot video goes through that process of creating restore points as well as using them after the fact.
Yeah, just a note also, it works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't work. But in many instances, it helped me restore my computer.
Good stuff.
So Harvey's asking if the Ottawa police are using either What3Words or postcodes.
Yeah, I have no idea, but I would doubt it.
Regarding System Restore, usually When you do a Windows update, it creates a system restore beforehand, and the same thing for many other things. And you can also, in the scheduler, set up creating a restore point when major things happen. And that will allow you to go back to multiple different points, and usually the most recent is the best because it was working then.
Yeah, I would highly encourage anybody who's going to count on that, go well in advance and just look and see what restore points you have available to you. You might have a lot fewer than you would really expect. My understanding was on Windows 11 that Microsoft, it's not really deprecated, but they were de-emphasizing system restore, even to the point that I thought at one point system restore was actually disabled and you had to manually enable it if you wanted it, but I may be wrong on that.
So Elizabeth had asked if we were broadcasting to the world that we have a one-on-one service for members, and Chris replied that there's no problem, we're happy to let the world know, but if the world wants assistance, they have to be members. So just bear that in mind if you're telling friends and relatives that we have this one-on-one remote assistance program. It's only going to be available to OPCUD members.
When I just looked at my system restore, which I never, in Windows 11, I never turned it on. This was a computer that came with Windows 11 on it. So I do have the last three Windows updates are available for system restore. So it looks like under Windows 11 by default. Oh, actually, they're all the same date and time, though. So it there are three entries, but they all have the same date, and time is identical for two of them, and one of them is 10 minutes or 10 seconds, actually, earlier. So basically, it looks like I have the last Windows update. It did a system restore beforehand, but it looks like it's only keeping one back on the system restore. So if you want to count on system restore, I highly recommend that you actually go in and make sure it's done more frequently than that.
And Harvey has looked up an article which indicates that Ottawa police are using What3 Words to help locate missing persons.
Cool.
Whether they've got around to plus codes or not, we don't know. Okay, so I think that's about it for tonight. So I'll just remind everybody that next week is our next Q&A session, October the 30th. If you have questions or topics that you'd like to share with your fellow attendees, then send us some details to the suggestion box so we can add that to the agenda. So that's it. Go ahead.
Do we have a poster for publicizing the one-on-one?
No, we don't.
Not yet, no. It was a fair amount of work getting the poster together for the Q&A sessions, so I'm not sure that we're going to go that route. But there is on our homepage a link to the full page explaining all of the details. And we may be looking to put a button or something on the homepage pointing to that later on. So that's still a little bit in flux, but look to some permanent location that'll be easy to find on our website.
And there is an article in the current newsletter which came out a couple of days ago and basically explaining the whole process. So that's a reference too. Okay, so thanks everybody for attending. Hope everybody enjoyed the stuff we had tonight, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, folks.